The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back to our reading of the July 2023 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. Well, this is going to be a good one for those of us who grew up in the 1950s and 1960s. It's entitled Rock, Roll, and Remember. Across North Carolina and through the years, artists of all stripes have contributed to an ever-evolving genre of music that's defined by its edginess and energy. When the needle drops on a classic rock record, it conjures memories that still inspire generations to grab a guitar and play, and sometimes pick up a pen and write, like Mark Kemp did for this article. It was all in the twirl. I couldn't do it. My feet would get tangled, and I'd wind up sprawled on the living room floor of my family's mid-century ranch home in Asheboro, like the coyote in those old Roadrunner cartoons. But Michael Roper could do it. He was my elementary school hero, tall and toothpick thin, with a perfectly coiffed afro twice the size of his head. Michael, in the early 1970s, personified preteen rock and roll cool. He'd stick thumbtacks in the heels of his boots so that they'd tap rhythmically on the linoleum tiles off Lindley Park School as he strutted down the hallways between classes, dancing, pirouetting, and singing every word to Jackson 5 hits like I Want You Back and ABC. I wanted to be Michael Roper. Better yet, I wanted to be Michael Jackson. From 1969 to 1973, the Jackson 5 were to my peers and me what the Beatles were to our older siblings and what Elvis Presley had been to our parents. They were thrilling, larger-than-life pop stars who appeared on our TV screens on Saturday mornings as cartoon characters, and then later in the evenings as living, breathing guests on variety shows like the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. With money I'd earned mowing lawns and delivering newspapers, I'd bicycle downtown to Archie Burkhead's record shop on weekends and buy every Jackson 5 album and 45 RPM single that I could afford. Then I'd cart them back home and retreat to the living room where I spent hours sitting in front of our big wooden stereo console surrounded by teeny bopper magazines and vinyl records. My living room was my sanctuary, with its mustard yellow carpet, gold chandelier, and upright piano that sat next to a window overlooking our front yard. It provided an escape from my hometown. By junior high, I'd replaced the teeny bopper magazines with issues of Rolling Stone and my J5 records with albums by harder, grittier groups like the Allman Brothers Band, Pink Floyd, and Parliament Funkadelic. I couldn't get enough of this music. When I put the needle to the grooves of a rock and roll record and listened as the first pops and crackles gave way to the glorious roar of electric guitars, I was transported to another world, one far away from the hosiery mills and dairy farms of Randolph County. Rock and roll and music magazines were my two tickets to paradise. I spent my high school years driving to concerts and festivals across the state. Left home to attend college at East Carolina University, where I studied English and took journalism classes, and eventually made a career in New York City and Los Angeles as an editor and writer for some of the very magazines that I devoured as a teenager: Rolling Stone, Cream, Spin. When punk rock and hip-hop arrived in the 70s and early 80s, I turned my back on the old rock and roll and embraced the new. But like Thomas Wolfe, I was ultimately lured back home to explore the music that I had initially had sheltered me in place. In 2004, I wrote Dixie Lullaby, a story of music, race, and new beginnings in a new South, a book that documented the uneasy convergence of Southern musical styles, the blues, jazz, gospel, R&B, folk, and country, that had given birth to rock and roll. Much of that converging, I found, had happened right in my backyard. If you're going to devote your life to rock and roll, you could do worse than come to North Carolina, whose majestic mountains, rolling hills, eastern flatlands, and miles of coastline have inspired some of the most inventive and cutting-edge popular music this country's ever produced. It all started with another kid from Randolph County, a mill worker named Charlie Poole. In 1925, he became one of the first big stars of country music, selling more than 100,000 copies of his song, Don't Let Your Deal Go Down Blues. During a period when selling 20,000 was considered a major hit, a time when only about 6,000 record players even existed in the southern United States. From the 1920s to the 1950s, numerous other North Carolina musicians in multiple genres surfaced, laying the groundwork for the rock and roll that would come to define the generation of post-war baby boomers who came of age in the 1960s. The short list includes Wadesboro-born singer and guitarist Blind Boy Fuller, who learned to play guitar as a youth and made a living performing for spare change on street corners outside tobacco warehouses in Durham and Winston-Salem. Fuller's pioneering 1930s Piedmont blues style would profoundly influence later rock and rollers like the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, and Led Zeppelin. There was the Hamlet-born, High Point-raised saxophonist John Coltrane, whose improvisational jazz of the 1950s would inspire rock and roll guitarists like Duane Allman of the Allman Brothers. There was Doc Watson of Deep Gap and Elizabeth Cotton of Carrboro, two inventive folk guitarists whose late 50s and early 60s ballads would serve as bedrock material for the New York City-based urban folk revival that spawned young, literary-minded singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. And then there was Link Wray, North Carolina's first bona fide rock and roller, whose 1958 hit Rumble was arguably the one song that had the greatest impact on all subsequent rock guitarists, from Jimi Hendrix to every kid who ever plugged an electric guitar into an amp and blasted their way into oblivion in their family's basement or garage. Something about North Carolina lends itself not just to the creation of great rock and roll, but also the promotion of it as an over-the-top theater, outrageous entertainment for working people. As a boy, Dolph Ramser, who grew up in a textile family in Concord, followed NASCAR and professional wrestling before moving on to music in his teens. Early on, Ramser, who today manages the Abbott Brothers and chairs the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, saw a connection between racin', wrestlin', and rock and roll. They all represented some form of rebellion, of anti-authoritarianism, So when it came time to promote the Abbotts, he looked back to the way that former Charlotte Motor Speedway president Humpy Wheeler had used wild, unexpected publicity stunts to help transform NASCAR from a Southern pastime into a national sensation. In the summer of 1972, I sat next to my friend Robert inside the cavernous Greensboro Coliseum, giddy with excitement. When the house lights went down, the screams intensified, and the flash cubes atop Kodak Instamatics popped. And then, pow, spotlights illuminated, zeroing in on the five lanky brothers who appeared on stage, as if by magic, all flowery suits and big afros, dancing, pirouetting, and singing every word to I Want You Back and ABC. Robert and I were attending our very first rock and roll concert, the Jackson 5, in person. One young girl at the front tried to scale the wall, separating the crowd from the stage. Another threw her a locket at Michael as he sang the funky I Want to Be Where You Are, and she cried when he crooned I'll Be There. This was my dream come true. Experiencing the music that I loved in my family's living room was one thing. Occupying the same enormous space as my musical heroes was quite another. After the concert, I went back home and studied the covers of every Jackson 5, Partridge Family, and Monkees record strewn about the living room floor. Combed through my teeny bopper magazines like they were textbooks, memorizing Michael's favorite groups, Sly and the Family Stone, the Staple Singers, and Led Zeppelin, David Cassidy's favorite snack food, dry roasted peanuts, and Davy Jones' favorite color, blue. And I continued sitting in front of our big wooden stereo console, eyes shut, headphones on, daydreaming of a world in which I could mingle with pop stars. Maybe one day, I thought, I'd be the one asking them about their favorite groups and snack foods and colors. Maybe I'd be a player in the arena of rock and roll. There's a sidebar here entitled These Magic Moments Take a Journey into North Carolina's Musical Past. Strolling through the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame is like walking the narrow, winding streets of a modern urban village. Only the street signs in this museum in Kannapolis have names like Country Road, Bluegrass Street, Jazz Alley, and Pop and Rock Zing. And instead of shops in the restaurants, exhibits display musical instruments, awards, clothing, and other memorabilia representing some of our state's most famous stars. In one corner, an elegant suit belonging to Durham-born Clyde McFatter stands next to a framed copy of Henderson native Ben E. King's number one hit in 1961, Stand By Me. In another, an acoustic guitar with a big red strap that reads Crash Craddock, the name of the Greensboro rockabilly singer whose Rub It In topped Billboard's country chart in 1974. And in yet another, portraits of Black Mountain-born soul singer Roberta Flack, next to a shimmery gold jumpsuit worn by High Point native and American Idol star Fantasia. Established in 1994, the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame has inducted 120 of the state's major artists and music industry insiders from the 50s and 60s, rock and rollers Link Ray, Little Eva, and members of the Shirelles, to country stars Ronnie Millsap and Randy Travis, to trailblazing jazz musicians John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, and Nina Simone. Dolph Ramser, manager of the Abbott Brothers from nearby Concord, and chair of the Hall's board of directors, says that the goal of the institution is to bring North Carolinians together through the power and nostalgia of our music. I grew up on a long line of textile workers, Ramser says, and that's important to me. It's very North Carolina. But when I think of the state's biggest contribution to the world, it's music. the best stuff to come out of these old mills was music. If you're interested in more information, visit NorthCarolinaMusicHallOfFame.org. And now, the beat goes on. During their historic 1964 debut on the Ed Sullivan Show, the Beatles instantly made Ludwig the world's most recognizable drum brand, inspiring a young musician in Charlotte to form his own Fab Four. At a factory in Monroe, Ludwig is still making those same guitars. Written by Brad Campbell. The second page is a full-page picture of a set of Ludwig drums, the name Ludwig and the L, the script of the L comes underneath, and the script of the G goes back in the other direction, and between those two it says USA. And the drums themselves are black and white swirls. And the caption says, "The black oyster pearl kit that Ludwig Drums manufactures at its sprawling campus in Monroe looks just like the set that Ringo Starr played when the Beatles invaded America in 1964. Is it possible to have your world permanently rocked while sitting cross-legged on the floor of a living room watching a black-and-white TV? If your name is Rob Thorne and the date is Sunday, February 9, 1964, the answer is an unequivocal yes. That's the night that Thorne watched the Beatles' seismic American debut on the Ed Sullivan Show. At the same time, Thorne was playing drums with the Catalinas, a well-known Carolina Beach music band. Tommy Plyler, the group's trumpet player, had been invited to a neighbor's house to watch the Sullivan Show, and Thorne tagged along. Assembled around the TV set in a Victorian-style house on Davy Avenue in Statesville, they witnessed the Fab Four make music history. Up until then, the emphasis in a rock and roll band was on the lead singer, not so much the accompanying musicians. Take Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Thorne says. You knew who Buddy Holly was, but you didn't know who the Crickets were. There was nothing personal about them. And then here comes Ringo. What Thorne saw when he watched the Beatles that night was a grinning, mop-topped drummer enthroned on an elevated rostrum for all the world to see, not hidden behind the rest of the band. Ringo Starr was driving the music, moving with the beat, swinging. What I heard was the pounding, full sound of his instrument, Thorne says. Most drummers played with more finesse. The licks were restrained, but Ringo was in your face. On that same February evening, back in 64, Bill Ludwig II, owner of a successful musical instrument company, tuned into the Sullivan Show with his family in a Chicago suburb. His company had provided the drum kit that Ringo played that night, and the Ludwig name appeared prominently above the Beatles logo on the bass drum, for all the world to see. I remember my dad watching them on TV and saying, "Who knows? Maybe these kids will be big someday." Ludwig's son, William Ludwig III, said in a 2008 Chicago Tribune interview, "If there is a Hall of Fame for understatements, then Bill Ludwig II's quip must certainly be in it." Terry Bissett, director of global sales for Ludwig, which is now headquartered in Monroe, picks up the story from there. Overnight, Ludwig became the most popular drum brand in the world. Soon, they were running production 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they still couldn't keep up with demand. It was for legions of other rhythm-minded teens that epical telecast marked a music conversion in Thorne. That night, he says, "I became a Ludwig man." Just 20 years old when he saw Ringo for the first time, Thorne had already been a professional musician for 9 years, following in the footsteps of his dad, who'd played trumpet for Les Brown and his Band of Renown, which featured a younger singer by the name of Doris Day. The younger Thorne started on trumpet too, but soon moved to his drums. His hero was Gene Krupa, whom he'd heard at age 7 on a double bill with Lionel Hampton's Big Band Jazz Orchestra at the Paramount Theater in New York City. "That sent me right through the roof," Thorne says. At age 13, he played his first professional gig with a dance band on New Year's Eve at the Elks Club in Charlotte. He then went on to join two other groups, the Deltas and the Jaguars, before joining the legendary Catalinas in 1961. In addition to their own repertoire, the Catalinas backed up a who's who of famous soul and R&B artists touring through the South, including the Shirelles, the Isley Brothers, the Drifters, the Inkspots, and North Carolina-born Little Eva. The Catalinas played to packed-to-the-rafters audiences in venues of every description, from sweaty university fieldhouses to fraternities, fragrant with the smell of stale beer to creatively named clubs like the Cellar in Charlotte, Joker's Three in Greensboro, and Royal Pines Casino and Swimming Pool south of Asheville. While Ludwig suddenly had the most famous drummer in the world endorsing their product and inspiring musicians like Thorne, they also had something else going for them. Bill Ludwig, the company's founder, and Bill Ludwig II were both drummers who understood the needs of musicians. Between them, they introduced several innovations in their years heading the company. The result was a distinctive drum tone that spoke to artists across multiple decades and musical styles, from Joe Morello and North Carolina-born Max Roach in the jazz era to Ringo, Ginger Baker of Cream, and John Bonham of Led Zeppelin in the rock era. Ludwig's innovations, which continue to this day, produced a very organic, raw sound, says Bissett, whose own ear has been fine-tuned by more than 50 years of playing percussion. These drums are alive. Ludwig was also legendary for its customer service, a quality that Thorne got to experience firsthand years later. By the early 80s, Thorne had fully embraced his inner Ringo and co-founded the Sponge Tones, a band devoted to reviving hallmark Mercy Beat sound of the early Beatles. When he wasn't on stage, Thorne doubled as a drum manager at Reliable Music in Charlotte. One day, a customer who'd special ordered a Ludwig Mahogany set received a couple of shells that didn't match. Thorne called the Ludwig plant and left a message, cheekily asking to speak to the head knocker. Soon thereafter, Thorne received a call from a man who laughingly identified himself as the head knocker. It was Bill Ludwig II, who invited Thorne to the factory to help straighten out the problem. When Thorne's hotel neared the plant turned out to be too noisy because of nearby construction, Ludwig invited the drummer to stay at his home. He had an incredible basement full of drums, and he put on a show for me, Thorne remembers. He couldn't swing like some of the other cats did, but he could play the hell out of those drums. By then, Thorne owned multiple Ludwig kits, and he'd used them to unlock the secret to the Beatles' drum sound. "Ringo's playing is so unorthodox, and I didn't understand it for the longest time," Thorne says. "Then I realized that he was a left-handed drummer who played with a right-handed setup." Most drum leads are dominant right hand, and his pattern started out with the left hand. Secret unlocked. Thorne's playing became the rhythmic foundation upon which the Sponge Tones built their successful sound and rabid fan following. The group became legendary for their shows at Charlotte's Freedom Park, where thousands sang and danced not just to the flawless Beatles covers that the band performed, but also to the Sponge Tones' own equally infectious original power pop tunes. In 1981, Bill Ludwig II retired and sold Ludwig to the Selmer Company, now Conn Selmer. It wasn't long after that, in 1984, that Selmer moved Ludwig's production from Chicago to Monroe, seeking to benefit from the abundant woodworking expertise of North Carolina's renowned furniture-making labor force. Located in a semi-rural area bounded by ball fields and brick ranchers, The four tidy Ludwig manufacturing buildings project a low-key presence that's at odds with the rollicking international reputation of the drums produced there. Inside, the vibe is decidedly more upbeat. Encouraged by management, the employees work to the music they love, transforming a routine factory tour into a movable feast of American song. Accordingly, each stage of the drum-making process has its own rhythm. In the woodroom, employees methodically sort through stacks of thin, laminated sheets of mahogany, cherry, maple, and oak that will soon be rounded into snares, toms, and bass drums. Elsewhere, workers move between state-of-the-art computer-controlled production equipment to tried-and-true drill presses, shell molds, and sanders that have been in continuous use since the 40s and 50s. And in the section of the plant devoted to metal drums, Ludwig craftspeople fit lugs and heads to glittering chrome and brass shells alongside shiny rows of enormous hammered copper bowls awaiting their transformation into timpani. The timpani are a reminder of Ludwig's long and successful history manufacturing percussion instruments for orchestras, marching bands, and large group assemblies. Even though Ludwig's artistry spans countless percussion styles and a who's who of performing artists, Ringo remains the star ambassador, illuminating the company's past. Some 59 years after the famous Ed Sullivan Show telecast, the vintage Black Oyster Pearl kit that Ringo played, now made right here in North Carolina, remains Ludwig's most popular drum model. And though performers like Ringo Starr, Rob Thorne, and countless others march to the beat of their own drums, they all share the same passion. "Most drummers I have ever known," Thorne says, "were maniacs for Ludwig drums." A sidebar here, marching to a different beat. With his Ludwig drums, a Greensboro music instructor puts a new spin on percussion. Ludwig's history of manufacturing marching percussion goes all the way back to 1909, when the company began making drums for military bands. Today's drummers like Harvey Thompson carry that tradition forward in new and wildly inventive ways. Ludwig and Dorsey artist Thompson serves as the drumline instructor for the North Carolina A&T State University Cold Steel Drummers and Blue and Gold Marching Machine. Thompson grew up in Brooklyn, New York, obsessed with perfecting tricks on BMX bikes and inline skates and doing anything that could grab people's attention. But when he saw his drummer friend Ralph Nader execute a left-hand stick twirl in front of their apartment building one night, the experience was every bit as life-changing for Thompson as seeing Ringo Starr in the Ed Sullivan Show was for earlier budding drummers. "I saw that and I said, oh shoot, I've got to learn this," Thompson says. Memorized by this new kind of trick, Thompson was soon a section leader in the Jackie Robinson Brooklyn Steppers March Band. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.